from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, some concerns about the all-electronic tolling system that's set to start on the Mass Turnpike in October. Also today, what could an influx of foreign investment mean for local biomedical lab space? And the challenges of depression among doctors in training.
I had sought help through a couple of different avenues and was really kind of beginning to despair about whether or not I would get better.
Plus, how a beloved Boston High School football coach went from mentor to murderer.
My coach had committed murder. We discovered he worked for the mob, and he was the featured criminal in 1990 on America's Most Wanted.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Massachusetts transportation officials are planning to start all electronic tolling on the Massachusetts Turnpike at the end of October. The new system, which was outlined at a state transportation department board meeting today, will also mean that drivers will pay different rates to use the pike. At today's meeting, state officials also said this new tolling system is capable of alerting police about specific license plates or transponders. While law enforcement officials say that information could be useful in helping to solve crimes, some civil liberties groups are concerned about how the information would be used and how it would be secured. We reached out to the State Transportation Department for today's show, but it said it could not make anyone available because of the ongoing meeting. A spokeswoman did say, though, that they are hoping to have recommendations about handling the tolling system data in the coming weeks. To discuss electronic tolling and privacy, we're joined by Jim Aloisi. He's a former State Transportation Secretary, and he's a principal at the Pemberton Square Group. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
And with us in studio is Cade Crockford. She's director of the Technology for Liberty Project at the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
Listeners, we want to hear from you as well during this part of our show. What do you think of the electronic tolling on the Turnpike? Are you concerned about how information about your travels might be used, or do you think that there will be safeguards in place to protect your privacy? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Jim Aloisi, let's start with you. You've served as general counsel to the Turnpike Authority. What do you think is the main benefit of electronic tolling like this?
Well, electronic tolling, and in particular all electronic tolling, which is what the Turnpike is moving toward, is of a huge benefit to motorists and to all citizens. It's a benefit to motorists because it's going to put an end to backlogs at toll plazas. And that means cleaner air at toll plazas because idling cars that stop at toll plazas have higher fuel emissions. It's going to mean faster trip times for motorists so that they have savings, real savings in time and fuel. It's an enormous benefit for everybody with respect to improved mobility. And it's really an expression of how technology in the 21st century can be put to good use, making our lives better, improving the quality of our mobility, improving the quality of our lives. As in any circumstance when there's change, you have to identify areas where there may be issues that need to be addressed. And certainly the subject of privacy is one that needs to be considered carefully, thoughtfully, not in an overwrought way, but in a thoughtful way. And I believe it's something that can be effectively addressed.
We want to talk about this hot list feature of these electronic tolls in just a moment. But first, I want to bring Kate into this conversation. What's your concern about these, the main concern, if you will?
Well, our concerns basically have the same – our concerns are basically the same with respect to the electronic tolling as they are with all sorts of information that we leave behind about ourselves today in the digital 21st century. And I totally agree with Jim. This seems like a step in the right direction for the Commonwealth. The really critical issue is to make sure that not only the policies that MassDOT implements to protect this information are in line with basic privacy and data hygiene principles, but also the state constitution and the federal constitution. And additionally, that we are thinking about this within the context of a whole lot of other technologies that are tracking us. So really, it's an opportunity for the government, for the state legislature, to think about ways in which it might want to look at not only addressing the issue of tolling records and this so-called hot list that might be implemented on the gantries on the Mass Pike, to alert, again, the state police to drivers, the location of drivers in real time, specific drivers, but to think about that within the context of lots of other programs. So, for example, license plate tracking programs that police departments have been using in Massachusetts for many years now, in addition to our cell phones. Our cell phones are tracking us also. Law enforcement can get access to that information, sometimes with less than a warrant here in the Commonwealth. So it's our view that this should be considered in context among a broad range of issues dealing with electronic privacy.
Now, the state says it is looking at various recommendations to come up with the policy and how to deal with all of this data. What would a good policy look like, first and foremost, in your opinion?
Right. So any data policy, and this pertains to private corporations as well as government agencies, should really have about five main principles. The first is collection. Only collect what you need for business processes. So, you know, I heard that the New Hampshire electronic tolling system only photographs license plates. It doesn't photograph the whole car. It doesn't seem necessary for the purposes of tolling to get an image of the bumper stickers and the drivers of the car.
And do you know if this particular system in Massachusetts would be able to capture more data than just the license plate?
I don't. That's one of the questions that we're going to be looking into. Mm-hmm. But so data collection is the first principle. Only collect what you need. The second is only use it for the purposes that you really need to use it for. So in this case, we're dealing with a tolling system. So the information collected for tolling purposes should only be used for tolling purposes. The third issue is access, both internal and external. So who has access to that information internally at MassDOT, as well as at the private corporation that's actually running this system for MassDOT, a company called TransCore. So how many people have access to that information? Is there an auditing trail? When someone looks up an individual plate number, is that search documented? Can people then go back through an accountability process and make sure that the system's not being abused internally, as well as external access? So that would be, for example, law enforcement. What are the rules for external access? So we would suggest, humbly, that law enforcement should be required to get a warrant to access stored location information held by the Pike, or rather by MassDOT, about people's driving habits on the Mass Pike, and that in these rare, very rare circumstances where we're dealing with this hot list situation, you know, only if someone's life is at risk would it be legitimate from a constitutional perspective for the state police to be notified in real time without a warrant of someone's location. And then the last thing would be data retention. How long are you keeping this information? So again, that pertains to the use provision. What do you need this information for? As soon as you've used it for that purpose, you can delete it. And unfortunately, I heard this morning at the meeting that the MassDOT is considering retaining the information for up to a couple of years, which seems, at least at first blush, to be too long.
Jim Aloisi, I'm wondering what you think about some of Cade's suggestions regarding how the a policy should be handled regarding this data on electronic tolling. But first, I just also, before you answer that, I want to remind our listeners that we want you to be involved in this conversation as well. What do you think about electronic tolling on the Mass Pike? It's set to go into effect at the end of October. There was a meeting today, a board meeting of state transportation officials talking about this electronic tolling. What do you think? Are you concerned about how your information might be used, or how it might be stored, or about how your travel information might be used? Or do you think there will be enough safeguards put in place? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Jim Aloisi, do you think we'll be able to put a policy in place that will be able to enhance public safety and protect privacy?
I have no doubt. And I think that the 5 points that we just heard sound like a reasonable framework to have this privacy discussion. I think for me, the subject sort of boils down to two components, right? There's the issue of the data repository. Where does this stuff go and how long does it stay in there and who has access to it? And then there's the issue of data use, which is how will we use it? And if we limit that use to legitimate sort of public security emergency type issues, and we should lay those out very transparently what they would be. And if we have protections on the data repository, I think it would be interesting to know, for example, what other potential uses Massport might see for this other than law enforcement, if there were legitimate mobility purposes for which it would be used, understanding times of day congestion, that sort of thing. I think we need to give the folks at MassDOT a chance to at least articulate, express what might be on their minds. But the idea that we, and this is true, by the way, what we're talking about here is happening everywhere in our lives. And so I think that state government, just like the federal government and local governments who are now in a position through a variety of sensors and other types of instruments that are capturing data, you really need to be thinking about a comprehensive approach to the question of access to the data repository and use of the data. And as I say, the framework that Kate put out seems like a good start, from my perspective, to have that conversation.
You know, we reached out to New Hampshire, which has electronic tolling in place, and it does have, that state has strict requirements on using data from electronic tolling. Police need to get a subpoena to access that information. The cameras, as you mentioned, Kate, are only allowed to take photos of a license plate. Is that a reasonable way to put this new system in place, Jim?
I think so. It sounds to me, well, first of all, I don't think, in terms of law enforcement, I think clearly we want to have the protections of our constitutional law. And so having a warrant or requiring a subpoena, unless there's some emergency situation, you know, if, God forbid, we had a situation like the Marathon bombers and they were going through a toll booth, I have no doubt that people would feel differently about the issue of their privacy. But those are very, very unique and rare, thankfully, circumstances. In the average circumstance, I think people should be, law enforcement should be asked and required to show some cause. I do think, to me, the important part here is to not let this issue, you know, this was a front page story in the Boston Globe, and when I see that, I worry that it gets people needlessly upset or that it becomes an overwrought discussion, when really it doesn't have to be. We all need to be prepared to embrace technology if we're going to live in the 21st century. What we need to do in a very calm and thoughtful way is to understand what we, you know, that legal framework that we as Americans believe in, have faith in, trust in, and expect government will have in every aspect of our lives to protect us, and apply those principles in a fair and reasonable way to the specific instance here, which is mobility.
Okay, I want to bring Kate in here. Kate, do people need to assume we've got this technology, we're going to use it, we will put enough safeguards in place, really?
So I just want to quibble a little bit, Jim, in the sense of urgency about this matter. You know, unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever, the reality is that technology moves much faster than the law. And we have, at the ACLU, tried to encourage the state legislature here in Massachusetts to pass a number of electronic privacy bills in recent years. They have not done so. And so, unfortunately, we are woefully behind in Massachusetts right now in terms of the statutory protections for all sorts of all kinds of digital information that we leave behind every day, both with our private internet providers and cell phone companies, as well as with government agencies like MassDOT. So I would just quibble with the sense of urgency issue. I do think that there is a real sense of urgency here and that the legislature should feel compelled to act, and that, you know, the Globe putting this story on the front page is a good thing in that respect, because while I agree that electronic tolling is good for transportation, I also think that the public needs to be very aware of not just the potential harms involved with, you know, unlimited data retention or warrantless law enforcement access to this kind of information, but more broadly, of all the different kinds of information that are being collected about us today and about the ways in which those data can be used for purposes that maybe in 2016 we don't even understand yet because they haven't been invented.
Right. And is there almost an attitude, well, there's so much data being collected about me. I mean, who could possibly sift through it all unless they had a real purpose to do so? I mean, you know, there's an overwhelming amount of data collected.
Well, that's right. And a lot of people at MIT are working very diligently right now to figure out ways to monetize that information, figure out ways to draw unique insights from it through a process called data mining, which is essentially, you know, using computer algorithms to derive new meaning from large data sets. So, you know, that's, again, Jim, we wouldn't disagree at the ACLU that, you know, anonymized information that doesn't contain unique attributes of individual people, so stripped of license plate numbers, stripped of credit card data and things like that, certainly MassDOT should be using this data in an anonymized fashion to look at traffic patterns so that we can better plan our public transport. You know, we're not
sure.
Luddites at the ACLU. We don't think that the information should just disappear. However, there is a real sense of urgency, I think, about what to do in terms of regulating how that information can be used when it's personally identifiable.
Well, I don't think we don't disagree on that. My concern was more about the fact that we haven't done this, and therefore people get anxious about something that they probably shouldn't have to be anxious about in the first place. I completely agree. Massachusetts fancies itself to be the innovation state of the East. Well, if we're going to be the innovation state of the East, we better start innovating when it comes to making sure that our laws match the pace of innovation. I understand, as you've pointed out, that innovation is at a rapid pace. Well, we need to move at a rapid pace when it comes to enacting laws and regulations and a sensible framework to enable our decision makers, at not just the MassDOT, but in many other agencies, to be able to keep up with the times. So these things go hand in hand with one another. Perhaps what today's story and discussion is about is sort of bringing that issue to the forefront so that we can cross whatever barrier needs to be crossed legislatively and otherwise and get this kind of thing done. Because we don't just risk more traffic congestion if we don't have an AET system. The dominoes will begin to fall. We need to begin to compete with other states nationally. And so if our laws are not keeping up with demand, then we need to insist that they do.
So you think we have laws on the books right now that will protect people's privacy sufficiently to be able to put this electronic tolling system in place and deal with the traffic part of it and also make sure that any privacy concerns are addressed?
Well, I think the law probably needs to be revisited. I'm pretty sure it does. When I was back in the 1990s, when we first introduced electronic tolling to Massachusetts, there was a law passed. As I believe it was passed as part of the comprehensive metropolitan highway system legislation back in the mid-90s. And if my memory serves me correctly, it did restrict the use of particular information at the toll plazas to legitimate state police, state investigatory work. It was pretty narrow. We were not anticipating the world of 2016 and AET. So my sense, not having looked at it recently, is that whatever legislation is on the books probably needs quite an update and refreshing. I'm sure the ACLU knows more about it and has a specific idea about how that will work if it's those five principles we heard about. Again, that makes sense to me. I just think we need to get off the dime on this so that we're not scaring people, A, and B, so that we're not unduly delaying the implementation of a new way of a reform, really, in collecting transportation revenue that is really critical, I think, to, as I say, less congestion, cleaner air, better mobility. We should be able to do both, chew gum and walk at the same time.
Okay, I want to get some listeners in with some of their questions as part of this. Dagmar is calling from Cambridge. Dagmar, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Yep, thanks. I want to say that my credit card for the last 10 years has been hacked on average once a year. And my information, all my information, including my social security number, has been hacked at the Boston Teachers Union and at the Boston Public Schools. If I'm forced to buy a transponder, I must submit credit card information, which then backtracking has also my social security information on it. So I am very opposed to it because in this country, data protection as is concerned with regards to hacking is woefully inadequate. You can look at other countries, for example, Germany, that has much stronger data protection in place, not from a legal point, from a technical point. And I would like to have in the bill included that I can be sent a bill afterwards. I want to be able to go through the tolls without a transponder, like in Vermont, being sent a bill afterwards and then pay the bill if it has to be.
Okay. I think we understand. So protecting the data and making sure that it isn't hacked. What do you say about that, Kate? Is that an issue?
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, in recent years, we've seen a number of high-profile hacks. Just this past summer, you know, the DNC hacks were released last year. The Office of Public Management at the federal government was hacked, and millions of federal government employees' very sensitive information was disclosed, likely to a foreign government. So, yeah, of course, hacking is a major issue of concern. And, you know, MassDOT has said that a private corporation called TransCore is going to be operating this tolling system. So it remains to be seen exactly what security protocols they'll have in place. But I'm assuming they'll use encryption at least to protect credit card information and things like that. To the caller, though, I would encourage her to look at some of the details of this plan because the pay-by-plate option will be in effect in Massachusetts. You don't have to get an easy pass, actually. So you don't ever have to give them your credit card number if you don't want to.
Right.
And additionally, today I heard them say that they're also going to allow people to get easy pass transponders and fill them with cash. So you can even use an easy pass, but never give them your credit card if you want.
Right. And keep in mind, hacking is not a legal issue. As far as I know, hacking is a technology.
But no, no, but the government
protecting,
has...
Protecting
the government has a responsibility to protect that information technologically,
no, no,
though.
But your license plate has all of your information if it's your car. It has a lot of your private information as well.
Well,
which,
so, yeah.
Yes.
And how would that be protected?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, again, you know, the RMV maintains those records. So the way that the system is going to work, my understanding of it at least, is that this company, TransCore, which is going to run the electronic tolling system, will actually facilitate the collection of the information from the highways, so the images and the data that's picked up from the transponders, and process the tolls through communicating with the larger system, you know, determine how long you drove, how many tolls you hit. If you don't use an EasyPass transponder, it's going to bill you, this private company, and it'll do that based on querying information from the Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles as well as registries of motor vehicles from other states nationwide, depending on where your car is registered. So my understanding is that there's no fusing of these data sets, but rather that this company will simply have access to information that's already held by the RMV.
Okay, I want to get... Oh, go ahead, Jim.
That's how MassDOT assures that you'll pay if you don't have a transponder and you drive through, they will take a picture of your license plate.
Right.
If you, and they'll send you a bill. If you don't pay your bills, the next time you try to register your car or renew your license, you'll be told at the registry that you could pay your bill or they won't do that.
All right. I want to just get a couple more calls in. Alan is calling from Brookline. Alan, you're on the air.
Hello. I was interested in the state enforcing our speed limits. Everybody in the inside 128 drives well over the 55 mile an hour speed limit, which has been mandated. It's called normalized obedience. Everybody does it because it's easy to do. But if a speeding ticket popped up in my mail two or three days after each trip on one of the highways, everybody would kind of think twice, either about driving over 55 or taking a different route.
Right. So you understand the traffic part of it, but what about the privacy part of it? Are you concerned?
I don't believe that data can ever be truly secured. And I think that... I work in the computer field. I'm a computer programmer. And people get hacked because of mistakes by people that do things, as well as due to errors in software design and such. And a law enforcement officer who needs the information about me is going to get it. He'll track my cell phone. He'll track my credit cards. He'll do what he needs to get that information. Mm-hmm. And I really don't have a problem with that. I could go, you have to go undercover to avoid that in this society.
Mm-hmm. So the information's out there, and the technology is out there, and we have to learn how to live with it. Is that essentially what you're saying, Alan?
Yes. Okay. Yes, for the most part. I mean, I'd love for things to be really private, but I'm unless you live in a cash society in a very rural area, it's probably not going to happen.
Okay, I want to take another call before we run out of time. Nico is calling from Gloucester. Nico, you're on the air.
Great, thank you so much. I was just calling because I have a transponder in my car, and my wife and I always used to fight about whether it used to be on the dashboard or in the center console. And I said that it didn't matter if it was in the center console, and she was obviously right because now I put it on the dashboard. But at the same time, we still get like, you know, those tickets, $40, $50, $60 every time we pass through the tolls, like going up to Portland, Maine. And I was just wondering if that is just because my transponder is out of date, or if that's like an actual like kind of technical problem that could be improved upon.
So you think there are technical errors with the transponders to begin with, and how does that figure into this whole system? Jim Aloisi, I'm going to let you take a crack at that in the last 40 seconds or so that we have here.
Well, so the New England states have agreements, I believe Maine, Hampshire, Massachusetts, have signed a compact. So the transponder is what we call interoperable, meaning it's seamless in any of the states. If you drive through the Hampton tolls in New Hampshire or the Maine Turnpike from Massachusetts and your transponder is either not working, can't be read because you put it in the wrong place, or you don't have enough money in your account, you will be charged for that by that state. And they may put a surcharge on that or not. I don't know exactly what the agreement calls for with respect to potential surcharge, but that's how that works. The transponder is either defective, it's in the wrong place in the car, or the person doesn't have money in terms of a balance. Those would be the only reasons why you'd be getting a charge. But the three New England states that I mentioned have a compact that's been signed so that it's a seamless drive through all of their toll facilities.
Okay. Well, Jim Aloisi, former State Transportation Secretary and Principal at the Pemberton Square Group, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We'll probably continue this conversation. We've got a lot of callers, but we're out of time. But thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Also, Cade Crockford, Director of the Technology for Liberty Project at the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. As international investors eye the U.S. real estate market, one area that appears to be attracting new foreign capital is biomedical research properties, especially in Greater Boston. According to reporting today by the Boston Globe's Robert Wiseman, nearly half of the commercial real estate purchases in this area last year were made by international buyers. Joining us to explain further is Robert Wiseman. He's healthcare and life sciences reporter for the business section of the Globe. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Deb. How are you?
Okay. So how much investment have we seen so far in Boston area lab space by foreign investors? How big of an industry are we talking about, I guess?
Well, the share of investing going into overall real estate in the Boston area is big. As you said, it's nearly half. Right now, they're only starting to put this money to work in the life sciences area. So there's been some high-profile properties already purchased by overseas investors, and there's a lot of interest on even bigger biomedical properties. So the wave is just starting. It's starting to move from the office market, the hotels, and high-end retail market to the biopharma lab market.
So give us a couple of examples that we might be able to sort of put a visual with of biomedical space that's been purchased by international investors.
Well, most of it so far has been purchased by European investors. There's a German company that invests money from wealthy German investors that has bought the Boston Design Center in South Boston, which is a former military warehouse that now houses all kinds of biomedical labs and other high-tech companies. Mm-hmm. There's a lab building outside Kendall Square on First Street that's owned by the same company. And there's in a separate German company, a subsidiary of Deutsche Bank, owns a lab building near Mass General Hospital in Boston. So those are three examples. There's also recent first-time bids by Norges, which is a Norwegian sovereign wealth fund that invests some of the North Sea oil revenues. And they bid on a One Kendall Square, which is a whole network of eight buildings that houses a lot of startups. Mm. And we're seeing more bids in the Longwood area in Boston, the Longwood Medical area, and elsewhere in Kendall Square, which is sort of the central part of the biopharma hub.
So what is it about biomedical lab space that makes it attractive right now, and why now?
Well, you know, it's been a strong market for a long time, but it's also been a very risky market. Now it's a red hot market, and I think more of these overseas investors are willing to take the risk. The vacancy rate is down under 5% in Greater Boston, under 3.5% in Cambridge, and there seems to be a lot of demand for the space. The leases are rising. There's an opportunity to make a profit. And I think the other alternative investments are seen as riskier, particularly in Europe. Mm-hmm. One of the real estate companies that I talked to sent a note out to clients saying that Brexit, the UK's withdrawal mm-hmm. from the European Union, is making London and some of the other European capitals less attractive to these overseas investors.
Is this unique to Boston, or is it happening in other areas that have, you know, strong biomedical industry components?
It's starting to happen in a number of those areas. Of course, there's only really a few. This industry is highly concentrated in the U.S. The San Francisco Bay Area is another hub, second to Boston. And just last week, a Chinese investor took a large chunk of a building in Mission Bay in San Francisco, which was seen as a harbinger of things to come, both in San Francisco and in Boston.
And is it logical to assume that this will create a huge price increase throughout the real estate industry?
Well, it seems like the prices have already been going up, and now you're adding additional demand. So that seems logical. So it'll make it'll be a great thing for sellers. In fact, it already has been a great thing for sellers. German company that bought the Kenmore Square building is now selling it again after only 3 years. And I think what this Norwegian fund, Norges, is looking to buy it for three times what the German company paid. So it will drive up prices, and it'll make it tougher for competitors, including some of the traditional U.S. companies that have dominated this industry.
All right. Robert Wiseman, healthcare and life sciences reporter for the business section of the Boston Globe. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Deb.
Well, it's well known that training to be a doctor is grueling. Long hours, lots of pressure, overnight shifts, few vacations. But what's not as well known is how that training affects the mental health of doctors in training, the interns and the residents who provide a lot of care in the teaching hospitals in Boston. Well, with me in the studio to talk about this is Carrie Goldberg. She's editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Welcome.
Thanks, Deb.
So this training has always been accepted, really, as sort of trial by fire on the way to becoming a doctor, right?
Absolutely. It's just a notoriously hard, hard period for these young doctors. And of course, some of that toughness is inevitable, right? But there's a rising focus on the really high emotional toll that these years of internship and residency can take, from depression and even right up to suicide. Just this last weekend, actually, there were public events held in 11 cities around the country to call for more action to prevent suicide by medical residents and doctors. It's estimated that about 400 doctors a year commit suicide, which is more, and their rates are more than double the general population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stark numbers. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at this at Common Health, is that right?
Right. We've just posted a really vivid first-person piece by Dr. Elizabeth Poorman. She's just starting her career in primary care in Everett now, but she was in her first year of residency at the Cambridge Health Alliance when she found herself sinking into a real clinical depression. And not because of anything her hospital did. They were very supportive, just because of the situation. It got just really hard.
I had sought help through a couple of different avenues and was really kind of beginning to despair about whether or not I would get better. And I was getting a lot of feedback from my colleagues that this is just residency, everybody goes through this. And I even got some of that feedback from different providers that I went to see. So I felt at that time, well, I can't keep feeling like this, so maybe I shouldn't be a doctor, which was a really devastating thought to have because I love medicine. It's always been my dream to be a physician. And I was really kind of struggling with where to go from there.
So, Carrie, what does Dr. Poorman say about why things were so bad for her and why they can be for other residents as well?
Well, you know, Deb, if you think about it, it's just such a natural, perfect storm for interns and residents. You're sleep deprived. You're in such a high stress job. You're seeing these really harrowing things happen to people that can be traumatic. And you may have been, you know, sent across the country to a residency program. You may not have your usual support system and no time to build a new one. Here's what Dr. Poorman says is one of the hardest parts.
Just not having any time to process, to create a life outside of the hospital, and to kind of work through those things that are necessarily going to be traumatic. You know, you're watching people that you care about and advocate for die and get sick, and you just don't have time to go home and discuss with your loved ones, you know, what's happening. And I think that people who may get through residency without experiencing any kind of mental health disorder, a lot of times are extremely lucky.
So, Carrie, do we know how prevalent mental health issues are during medical residency?
Well, we're getting a better idea. There was a review article published just late last year that estimates that almost a third of doctors in training get clinically depressed. But those numbers range, depending on the study, from about 20% all the way up to 43%. And if you figure, you know, people tend to underreport or deny things like depression, it's a really impressive proportion of doctors in training.
And I'd imagine that some doctors who went through their own training might be resistant to the idea that this rite of passage is so brutal that it's causing not just distress, but mental health issues.
Right. They may be. And, you know, in her Common Health post, Dr. Poorman implores more senior doctors to understand that they're not just being wimps, that medicine has changed a lot in the last few years and gotten even harder for residents. They have less time than ever to spend with each patient, for example. One study found it was as little as 8 minutes on average per patient. And meanwhile, even though, you know, there are these new restrictions that prevent residents from working more than 80 hours a week, you'd think that would be good. But on the other hand, that cuts their time to connect with patients. And the work has gotten harder in the sense that on a given overnight, a resident might be responsible for from 40 to 80 complex patients. And the scheduling has gotten tougher, too. One resident compares what they do to taking a transatlantic flight every 3 or 4 days.
So how does she suggest that we fix this system so it's easier for residents and doctors to get help if they need it?
Well, you know, I think she, Dr. Poorman, and others like her are taking a really big first step just by helping to bring this issue out of the closet. And it makes perfect sense to me, and I'm sure to many others, that once it's out in the open, that depression and anxiety and other mental health challenges are a really common response to the stresses of becoming a doctor. Here's how Dr. Poorman puts it.
The biggest thing is that we continue to treat mental health disorders in residency as the exception. I would argue that they're the rule. It is very rare for people to get through residency without experiencing a mental health disorder. So I think, you know, being proactive about making it a lot easier for residents to access therapy, and then also just regularly kind of debriefing in a safe environment where administrators are not present, and kind of talking about the natural trauma of day to day so that we can also be a support to each other.
And Deb, one thing Dr. Portman points out in what she wrote is that residents need access to therapy not in the hospital where they're working. Some are concerned about that. And also that when you apply for a medical license in Massachusetts, you have to explain any gap in your training, and that could discourage residents from taking time off even if they need it.
But she also says that there are some pragmatic measures that could help, right?
Yes. And, you know, her central point is that medical training is never going to be easy. There is a lot that the trainees need to learn, including actually some humility for many. And also there are tragedies that they're just powerless to change, but there is more that could be done. And one ironic final note, she writes that she had worried that she'd be seen as less of a physician if other people knew that she'd had a mental health problem. But in reality, her experience with depression has made her a much more compassionate doctor and colleague.
All right. Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Carrie, thanks.
You're welcome.
And listeners, you can find a link to Dr. Portman's Common Health piece at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, how did a legendary Boston high school football coach go from conference champion to maximum security prisoner? That's the question explored in a new memoir about Clyde Jack Dempsey, the charismatic line coach of the Don Bosco Bears in 1974. Just a year after starting to coach at the now-closed technical high school, Dempsey led the perennial last-place team to victory in the Catholic Conference Championship. 1974 would be the only year Bosco won the conference. But in a striking turn of events, less than two decades later, Dempsey was convicted of second-degree murder. He would be found out as a Boston mob enforcer, and he was given a life sentence at Cedar Junction, where he died in 2001. Kevin Kelly was a lineman on Dempsey's 1974 team, and he's written about his relationship with Dempsey and Dempsey's fall from grace in his new book titled Both Sides of the Line, My Coach, the Boston Mob Enforcer, My Mentor, the Murderer, The True Story of Clyde Dempsey and the 1974 Don Bosco Bears. Kelly is also the Dean of Students at Deerfield Academy in Western Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us about the first time that you heard of Coach Dempsey, because he was legendary before he ever came to Bosco, according to your book. And how did you hear about him, and what sort of myths surrounded this man?
Well, the first time I heard of Coach Dempsey was in the eighth grade, 1971. My older brother, Tom, was a senior at Don Bosco. And he had come home from a game, and I thought by the way he was sitting on the bed that they had lost, and they had played against St. Columbkills that was out in Brighton, and they actually won the game. But my brother was sitting there somewhat in awe, out of respect, because they only had 14 players on the team, and he said they were the toughest 14 kids they ever played against, and they had a coach, legendary coach over there named Jack Dempsey. And my brother went on to tell me that he was a notorious street fighter, and went on to share a few of those stories. So I was only in the eighth grade and had no idea at that time that eventually he'd become a pivotal person in my life.
A street fighter who at one time bit someone's ear off.
That's correct, yeah.
Those were the stories going on about him.
Yeah, he was a notorious street fighter, had a reputation that even the toughest guys on the street didn't want to fight him.
So all of a sudden, there you are, 1973, and you're told that this notorious street fighter is going to be your new coach.
Well, it was interesting because at that point, I wasn't 100% sure it was the same man. And then when Coach Dempsey came into the room, just by the description for my brother, I had a sense it was him. Very quiet, very assertive, physically 5'7", 210, just a massive presence on a physical level. And later on would become a master mentor, teacher, coach, surrogate father to many of us. And he really will take the program after two consecutive years of being in the cellar of the Catholic Conference. And him and Coach Currier, who was the legendary head coach at Don Bosco, will take the program and we'll have the Cinderella season my senior year.
Right. So tell me what he was like as a coach. You said he was a mentor, a father figure to many people. Tough, I would assume.
Very tough. But as a football coach, he was a master teacher of technique. His holy trinity was quickness, technique, and desire. That size meant absolutely nothing. He was a master teacher.
Well, at 5'7", maybe he had to think that, right?
He was a two-time All-American that came out of Boston English, and that's exactly what happened. His career was all built on his football intelligence. Mm. And so, he's more than just a regular football coach to us, as I mentioned before. He really gives us a roadmap for me personally, but for many of my teammates. He gave me a roadmap on not only how to be an athlete on the football field, but how to lead my life, becoming a young boy to becoming a young man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he didn't seem to take those lessons to heart personally, obviously. If he was, what was going on there?
I would tell you that Coach lived in two worlds, and I believe in my heart that the Coach Dempsey that I had a relationship with believed in everything that he was preaching to his kids, and that in one avenue of his life he indeed lived that life, and on the flip side he had this the opposite end of the spectrum, if I may, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde complex, where he was equally as good in the bad world as well. He was tough. A collector for the mob, and then later on he'll commit this murder.
He was as you said, he did collect debts for the mob, apparently, which he admitted to you, as you recount in one part of the book. But he also was convicted of a murder that no one seemed to really be able to make sense of in a crowded nightclub in Boston at one point.
Right. In 1981, 6 years after I graduated, he's in a nightclub in Boston, has an issue with a young man. He'll pull out a gun and he'll shoot that young boy, who was at the age of 24 at the time, and then he'll go up to Canada.
And he hid for 9 years, right?
Hid for 9 years, 10 years, something along those lines. And he will go into a cemetery and he'll steal the identification of a baby out of a cemetery, which allowed him to get a new birth certificate, which allowed him to get a driver's license, which allowed him to be employed. And he'll reinvent himself as Ronald Mayor. And it will all come to an end for him, as he was, in 1990, the featured criminal on America's Most Wanted.
And that's how he was caught.
Yes, eventually. Yeah.
When he was on America's Most Wanted. But I just wonder, I mean, he obviously had a very dark, dark side, which, you know, you sort of knew about from these stories about mm-hmm. him being a legendary street fighter, but this sort of went further, I guess, for, mm-hmm. for lack of a better way to explain it. How is it possible? Is it possible for someone to live two very different lives like that? Or were there times when you definitely saw that really dark person who was mentoring all of these young men?
Well, it's a great question. I think if we look at us, you know, as a species, and you take a look at issues with the Catholic Church, with the priests, if you take a look at politicians, there's a lot of people who show one side of themselves, and there's something else going on inside them. I had heard plenty of what Coach had been doing, but I had never seen it. I was fortunate enough to play for the Hyde Park Cowboys, which was a semi-pro team in the Eastern League. We were teammates in 1976. I had seen a lot of cocaine. I had seen a lot of alcohol and drinking, you know, throughout, you know, either the nightclubs and those type of things or the gatherings afterwards. And I never once did I see Dempsey out of control. But it was understood that, you know, his cocaine use was increasing, and that whether that particular night, he was drunken with cocaine. Would he have done the same thing if he was sober? He certainly didn't need a gun to settle an issue between another person. So that's the magic question. We'll never know for sure exactly why an issue that went between him and another kid that wasn't really that hot of an issue went from 0 to 100.
And just lastly, you talk about a list of issues that he had, legal issues and others. And at one point, you did a practice drill that actually resulted in a fellow team member being paralyzed for the rest of his life. These are things that would be unheard of today.
Right.
which I think is good in some aspects, but I wonder if there's anything negative about that. Is there something lost in the way that, in the freedom that coaches are allowed now, in the way that things are done?
Great question. Yeah, I think, as we say, the old school, you know, coaches had a wide range of power. Mm-hmm. And I still think, in of all sports, football, that probably still exists, especially if you look at Division I coaching. But yes, in that particular time, it was a tragedy. It was a tragic mistake. It tore away at the coaches. The one thing I do mention in the book, during that time, there was absolutely no counseling. There was no help for anyone. Right. No one came to the team. There was no counselor. There was no priest. We went to an all-boys Catholic school. No one spoke to the team. No one spoke to the boy who delivered the hit. And it was a punishment drill. And years later, as I interview my teammates, that was the number one memory that came up within about 30 or 40 seconds of all the interviews.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Kevin Kelly is the Dean of Students at Deerfield Academy. His new book is titled Both Sides of the Line, My Coach, the Boston Mob Enforcer, My Mentor, the Murderer, the True Story of Clyde Dempsey and the 1974 Don Bosco Bears. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. Austin.